Lucky to have Alan Roberts and Mike Leventhal with us. Alan is a partner with Cooper Roberts Architects in Salt Lake City. He's been there for 15 years, and before that he was State Preservation Architect with Utah State Historical Society. And then in 3 years he was co-editor and co-publisher of Sunstone, so he's pretty well known to all of us, and 5 years editor associate of Dialogue. And he was too modest to add, but of course we all know that he co-authored Salamander with Linda Sillitoe. And most important about Alan is that my 70-year-old mother is crazy about him, and before she moved, his picture was on her bulletin board. And so move over, Patrick Swayze. Anyway, and then we have Michael Leventhal, the executive director of the Utah Heritage Foundation. And before that, he was director of the Mobile Historic Development, Development in Mobile for 11 years. And before that, during that time, for about 2 years, he was director of the Preservation Alliance in Mobile and Montgomery. And before that, he was with the National Trust for Historic Preservation for 7 years, I believe, and that was in Washington, D.C. So with no further ado, I will turn the time over to them. This is a very interesting subject. I hope we have a few minutes left. We'll try to leave a few minutes because I'm sure a lot of you will have some very good questions. A look at Mormon historic preservation. Maybe some of you had the reaction. Some of my friends have said, I didn't know there was a Mormon historic preservation. That's people that live close to the Hotel Utah. So this should be very interesting. I think you should all take long notes. Thank you.
Thanks, Peggy. Perhaps it could be more interesting given the crowd. Maybe they ought to stock Thursday morning sessions with topics like metaphysical euphoria and human sexuality or something to draw a bigger crowd. I also would like to give condolences to Michael for having to put up with someone who delivers a paper to his doorstep at 10 p.m. the night before it's presented. So I deserve anything I get out of him. I'm going to present something which is more personal than scientific, kind of my response to the preservation effort in the church. First, I'll give some personal comments, then show some slides, and then hopefully end up with a proposal, really, to the church as to how it might improve on its stewardship regarding historic properties. As a young man growing up in the LDS Church in Wisconsin, California, and eventually Utah, my impression was that the church had a specific interest in both good architecture and historic preservation. This opinion existed because of the excellent quality of the Milwaukee Ward Meeting House I had attended church in most of my life, a marvelous Elizabethan Tudor Revival building crafted in limestone and oak, together with my early 1960s experiences in Nauvoo, where the church had begun a major restoration effort. Wisconsin had very few Mormons at the time, and we had no stakes at all. I remember traveling to Chicago for stake meetings held in the University Ward, another refined and splendidly designed Mormon edifice, a Gothic Revival church, the equal of the religious buildings attended by my non-Mormon friends. And of course, our family's frequent summer vacations to Utah exposed me to the majesty of the Salt Lake Temple and Temple Square. As a youngster, I assumed that the church had always been committed to producing exquisite architecture. Furthermore, based on the preservation of Nauvoo, Temple Square, the Lion House, Beehive House, I could see that the church was proud of its past accomplishments and was intent on preserving its finest sites and buildings, providing interpretive experiences for members and visitors. Having been raised in older homes, in older neighborhoods and urban centers, and having been exposed to many museums, art galleries, and historic buildings throughout my childhood and adolescence, I came to develop an early fondness for history and things historical. I was particularly interested in church history. My own identity was closely tied to the epic story of Mormon genesis, struggle, persecution, journey, and eventual conquest in the desert. A misunderstood and unwanted people persevere and succeed in the unwanted place, which they transform into a beautiful Zion community. All along the way, they leave monuments to their greatness. Their cities, temples, tabernacles, and ward meeting houses stand as evidence of the validity and worth of the effort. Somehow, our present validity as a church and individual members, symbolized by the high quality and enduring nature of the built environment left by our Mormon forebears. At least, such were my thoughts as a youth. To me, it was wholly consistent that the church's purposes would be served by what seemed to me to be a church-wide preservation policy. My awareness that historic preservation was not a church-wide policy came suddenly in 1971 with the announcement that the church intended to demolish the Colville Tabernacle. I was studying architecture in Brigham University's now-defunct environmental design program and remember how the shockwaves traveled through the department as we were told the news of the building's imminent demise. I had never seen the Colville Tabernacle. In fact, I had never been to or even heard of Colville. But when I saw the photographs of the building, a flamboyant, multi-spired, upward-reaching Gothic Revival building with superlative stained glass and portraits of the prophets painted on the ceilings of the chapel, I immediately understood the reason for the alarm. Department Chair Milo Boffman, a Mormon convert and an internationally disowned designer, quickly mobilized the department to picket the site and protest the proposed demolition. Although I was a very active and fully Orthodox church member, Boffman's plan made perfect sense to me. The tabernacle was an architectural jewel. Obviously, some middle-level bureaucrat had made an error, and we simply had to call attention to the error to church leaders, and they would step forward and correct it. My naivete was matched only by Boffman's. When the church officials got wind of the planned departmental protest march in Colville, it was stopped dead in its tracks. BYU faculty and students did not picket buildings or protest the inspired decisions of church leaders. In retrospect, I see the challenging of church authorities from within more threatening and more far-reaching in its consequences than the preservation controversy which spawned it. While the tabernacle was taken down by bulldozers operating in the pre-dawn moonlight, the environmental design department was also eliminated. Its faculty and students were sent on their ways, and many lives were altered. But that's another story. Although I was one of the students impacted by the dismantling of the department, I picked up the pieces and went on. Still, I was never reconciled to the demolition of the tabernacle or the manner in which the incident was handled. I thought to myself, either the church possesses such an abundance of significant architecture that such buildings as the Colville Tabernacle are expendable, or the church is not really safeguarding its architectural and historical resources. I decided I needed to learn for myself which of these was true. With the zealousness and fervor of a crusader, I spent virtually all of my free time over the next 5 years researching the historic Mormon architecture of Utah. I bought an old Volkswagen and traveled to every city, town, and ghost town in the state. I photographed every tabernacle, meeting house, relief society hall, bishop's storehouse, stake office building, seminary, tithing office, granary, endowment house, and every other kind of building that had any ecclesiastical connection with the church. In several archives, I researched the histories of buildings I was finding and soon learned that many more buildings had already been razed, including some very impressive tabernacles and meeting houses and at least 8 buildings on Temple Square. As I researched, I wrote brief histories and descriptions of each building and collected photos in a set of 3-ring binders. I was surprised to learn that no one had previously made a comprehensive study of the church's architecture. Plowing new ground came to be an exciting adventure, and my discovery of wonderful buildings each time I made an excursion fueled my effort. Over a 5-year period, I documented more than 300 church-related structures built before 1930. Because I was spending a lot of time in church and state archives, my searches came to the attention of church historian Leonard Arrington, as well as historians at the State Historical Society. They together funded a fellowship resulting in a limited publication of my research in an inventory book entitled A Survey of LDS Architecture in Utah, 1847 to 1930. Completed in 1974, this 325-page document and 4 binders of photos were appreciated by the historians and preservationists aware of them. Thus, I was encouraged to continue my architect investigations. In 1974, I took a job at the State Historical Society as their first architectural historian, and in 1975, my first major article on Mormon architecture was printed in the Historical Quarterly. About the same time, I joined Cornerstone, a Mormon preservation group which no longer exists, and began attending meetings of the Mormon History Association. In 1975, I became affiliated with Sunstone, publishing the cover article in the first issue, a short piece on Mormon stained glass windows. I've dragged you through these reminiscences and indulged in this bit of personal history for a purpose. My career as an historic preservationist and eventual architect and writer developed as a drawn-out response to the demolition of a building I never even got to see. A non-existent building held a powerful emotional grasp on me. I still find this difficult to comprehend and even more difficult to explain. I do know that my career has continued along its steady course because the Colville Tabernacle raising was not an unusual, isolated incident, but part of a pattern of cultural destruction. A year or so ago, I reviewed the list of church buildings I had documented 15 years earlier and found that at least a third of the buildings had either been destroyed or sold since my study in the early 70s. Thankfully, some important buildings have also been restored during the same period, but the rate of demolition has clearly outpaced that of preservation. Every single community in the Mormon cultural area has suffered significant losses of its religious architecture. In some cities, not one historic church building remains. At the present rate of demolition, there may soon be entire counties or even large sections of the state devoid of the architecture which once gave it its Mormon character and identity. In defense of the church's demolitions, an official once told me that, quote, the church is interested in people, not buildings. My belief is that good architecture helps produce good people. Winston Churchill once said, in effect, first we design our buildings, and then our buildings design us. The primary reason preservationists promote saving historic buildings is because of the impact, positive impact, these resources have on the people that use and see them. Thus, I have been long interested in the effects on people of both demolition and preservation. I have found that my own strong reaction to destruction of cultural environment is far from unique. Many others share similar feelings and have a deep affection for the physical remnants of their past. In fact, it seems that lay members, the ones whose ancestors actually built the structures and who themselves had their primary religious experiences in the structures, nearly always favor preservation over demolition and new construction when given a choice. Most often, local people chew decisions to save a local landmark and lament and even agitate if they are lost. It might be easy to cast preservation as a great virtue and demolition as an evil, but the issue is far more complex and difficult than first meets the eye. Unlike historic paintings, books, and clothing, and other artifacts, buildings sit on real estate. They were also built more for functional than for artistic reasons. That is, their existence is justified by their utility in meeting the specific needs of the users. As users' needs change, buildings are either modified or considered obsolete. Obsolete buildings are often demolished because of their perceived inability to comply with any number of requirements, such as a workable floor plan, adequate amount of usable space, energy-conserving design, structural and seismic standards, handicapped access, code compliance, low maintenance characteristics, among others. For some, inadequacy in any one of these areas is justification for disposing of a building. For buildings with difficulties in several of these areas, preservation becomes even more problematic. Economic issues like developing a property to its so-called highest and best use may come into play, along with criteria related to function, safety, convenience, economy. Subjective matters of taste and stylistic preference may also influence a decision to replace an old building with a newer one. As with residential, commercial, and public architecture, some people simply get tired of looking at or dealing with old buildings. The idea that preservation somehow impedes progress is a source of constant debate. One of the spokesmen of progress, in quotes, voiced his opinion that the Salt Lake Theater should be razed. He said, quote, I am one of those imperturbable individuals who would grind up Plymouth Rock for gravel. Let's get rid of the old Salt Lake Theater and every other ugly old structure which stands in the way of development just as soon as we can, unquote. Despite enormous support for saving the theater, it was razed in 1928, a few years after the destruction of two of the city's other beloved landmarks, the Social Hall and the Gardo House. A decade earlier, the Deseret Store, perhaps the most used building in territorial Utah, was razed so the new Hotel Utah could be built. One historic building was replaced by a structure which, in time, would become equally historic, such as the layering process of civilization, especially in urban settings. Although the Mormon culture has lost many significant buildings, it has also retained, restored, and kept in use many others. The church's eastern historic sites are well known and kept, I believe, both because of their historical importance and for their proselyting value. The same can be said of the restoration efforts of both the LDS and RLDS churches in Nauvoo, Illinois. Anyone familiar with Salt Lake City and Utah generally will understand that the church has sponsored extensive restoration activity here. Temple Square, the Beehive and Lion Houses, the Church Administration and Relief Society buildings are the most apparent examples. Other public and private entities have saved such church-related sites as the Devereaux House, Old Deseret at Pioneer Trail State Park, the 18th Ward Meeting House, Council Hall, along with several monuments such as Eagle Gate, this is the Place Monument, the Mormon Battalion Monument. The preservers of these sites and monuments deserve credit for the cultural sensitivity. The church especially has invested millions of tithepayers' dollars in such restorations as the Assembly Hall, the Osmond Dual Cabin, several tabernacles, along with less notable structures such as the Temple Square Inn. Still, we are dismayed by the loss of the interior of the Logan Temple, the Eagle Gate Apartments, Gordon Place, and a large number of historic tabernacles and meeting houses. And as we look forward to the ongoing restoration of Cole Fort in central Utah, we stand in suspense as we await the fate of BYU Lower Campus and the Vernal Tabernacle. Clearly, the church's preservation record has been checkered with many high and low points. Also clear is the fact that historic preservation is not an important priority with church leaders, especially given the church's many other programs and economic demands. The church will never preserve as many buildings and sites as preservationists feel they should. The frustrating aspect of this particular preservation issue is the church's lack of consistency. While some worthwhile buildings are being saved, other extremely deserving buildings are not. Why is this? What factors contribute to a church building's preservation or demolition? If we can isolate the positive factors, can a strategy be developed to enhance the preservation effort? Along with questions of practicality, let us also consider the accompanying philosophical questions. What is the meaning of history for church members, and what is the value of historical resources, including buildings, and reinforcing a sense of religious and community heritage? What is the possible universe or scope of church preservation? What benefits would accrue to the church and its members if greater preservation activity were to take place? I'd like to leave my text now and go to slides and look at some case studies, look at some examples on both sides of the issue, and sort of get a sense of the church's preservation history. So let's hit the lights and turn on the slides. So I don't think the projector is on, actually. There it is. It is. I'm going to go through these quickly. Can we turn the lights off? Thanks. My introduction to church historic sites, like many of yours, I'm sure, started with trips to the east and looking at places like Joseph Smith's home in Nauvoo and other of the even further east Smith family and other Mormon figure sites, the Harmony, Pennsylvania home, and so forth. And the church has done a good job of keeping these properties, even obtaining more, and I think they have intent to do even further restoration in the east. Kirtland Temple, a building I saw early, which is not owned by the Mormon church, still has been retained, and we can see the ingenuity, the craftsmanship, the talent of our Mormon forebears. The interior is quite remarkable and has been kept in a fairly good state of preservation. Of course, Temple Square, it goes without saying that the church will always maintain a strong interest in the quality of Temple Square, and you can tell by the work now going on at the temple that this will always be the case. The restoration of Nauvoo, we could talk for hours about the pros and cons of what has been done there, and we don't have time to do that. Basically, because of the vision of Leroy Kimball, parts of Nauvoo were purchased. David O. McKay was very sympathetic to the restoration effort there. Non-Mormon experts from Williamsburg and other places were brought in as consultants, and they joined with the Mormon professionals to come up with a master plan for historic restoration interpretation. Later, as buildings were restored and the costs came in and church priorities and leadership changed, I think the shift occurred from primarily historical emphasis to more of a proselyting emphasis. Some of the restorations, while well-researched and of high caliber, others are more speculative, and in fact some of the reconstructions are based on really little information at all. No photographs, very little archaeology. The Scoville Bakery, for example, apparently was a one-story frame building, not a two-level brick building. And so there are some problems, even though a lot of good has been done. The Mansion House and other buildings have also been restored by the RLDS Church. This is the building that I never got to see, the Coville Tabernacle, really like a cathedral in a small town. In fact, one person observed that they should have kept the tabernacle and leveled the town. I don't agree with that. That's a little harsh, but a really spectacular building. The interior was extremely tall, remarkable. Unfortunately, in the 40s, a floor was put in, cutting the chapel in two. That big vertical space was cut in half, and that was a justification used by church leaders to destroy the building, that its integrity being compromised. Of course, they were the ones who compromised it. But the ceiling was elegant with pictures of the prophets painted on the ceiling, and really an extraordinary building. Here's the destruction going on, taking out the windows, salvaging them, and this building ended up being this building. So it got to me. Coming back to preservation history, the DUP really, I think, did the first preservation effort. They, starting in the 1890s, they saved the Chase Mill, which is still unrestored, and brought a very large number of small meeting houses, log cabins, relief society halls, tithing offices, and made of them relic halls. They are not well-funded. Their membership is in decline, and so it's a problem as to what to do with these buildings. They have saved them, but they really haven't preserved them, and they don't have interpretation there. So some of these DUP buildings really need a lot of help. Let's just go faster. The church put in excess of $2 million in the assembly hall, a really major restoration, a complete job. But unfortunately, some aspects were not restored. Look at the ceiling. The ceiling had paintings of the Mormon temples as they had been designed at the time. Most of them weren't even completed when this building was completed, as well as pictures of Peter, James, and John, Jesus, other people. That was painted out so that all that was left is the all-seeing eye, and then acoustical tile was put over the top of all of that. So there's a question always about not should it be done, but how it should be done. The quality of the restoration, the basis of it needs to be considered. Of course, in the 60s, there was an attempt to destroy the Lion House, Beehive House, Church Historian's Office. This is one of the first photos ever taken in Utah of these buildings. And the entire set of buildings designed by and directed by Brigham Young came under attack during the early 20th century. Here's Heber J. Grant, who was the president while the Social Hall, Gardo House, and Salt Lake Theater were destroyed, although he attempted to intervene in behalf of some of those, and David O. McKay, who attempted to keep the Nauvoo Project going. These buildings, fortunately, were saved, and that valuable piece of real estate was not put to its, quote, highest and best use. The 60s restoration was quite extensive, and we're very fortunate to have these buildings remain with us today. The summer home of Brigham Young in St. George was also restored, and the Jacob Hamlin House down in Santa Clara. So there has been a history of not just looking at the preservation of church buildings and temples, but also the other buildings that help document the lives of important people. Unfortunately, we've lost a lot as well. The Brigham Young Schoolhouse is gone. The Gardo House, which sat across from the Beehive House, was torn down for the Federal Reserve Bank, which then was torn down for an office building that's there now. This actually was repainted and renovated just a few years before it was demolished. The Desert Store, which could have easily been a National Register site, was replaced by the Hotel Utah, which itself now is on the National Register. other buildings that didn't make it. Brigham Young's White House on South Temple, 1849. His house in Provo. I guess it wouldn't be too good to save all of his houses because it brings attention to the possibility of his being a polygamist. Daniel Wells's house and the houses of many other famous church leaders have not been preserved. There's no organization out there to do that. The first ZCMI, the Eagle Emporium, is actually now hidden under the facade of another building. We have saved a number of monuments. The original wooden eagle is at the DUP Museum and is replaced by a metal one. The Mormon Battalion Monument will be restored this coming year. This is, of course, these types of things will remain with us. Brigham Young has moved around from Temple Square to various positions on the corner of South Temple and Main, and now points, people say, in derision to the bank instead of to the Temple Square. But the interior demolition of the Logan Temple and the what some people consider to be an incompatible addition to the side of the building actually contributed to the restoration, the sensitive restoration of Manti. So throughout the church's history, there are these trade-offs, highs and lows. It's a bittersweet thing. Other buildings were saved during the 70s. Spencer W. Kimball stepped in single-handedly, reversed the decision to tear this building down, and saved the church's oldest continuously used meeting house, the Bountiful Tabernacle, also our best Greek Revival building. Spring City's Tabernacle was saved and compatibly added to in the 70s. The Manti Tabernacle has been renovated and kept. Provo without the tower has been renovated. And so we have to give plus marks for all of these projects. Loa, this building has been saved down in southern Utah. Alpine Stake Tabernacle, kind of an awkward building in American Fork. The really impressive, almost medieval Bear Lake Stake Tabernacle. And the Logan Tabernacle, which was done recently. As well as St. George, which I think is... I see Glenn here. I think there's a project underway right now involving the renovation of the St. George Tabernacle, probably our finest New England period project. However, for each of those buildings, each of those tabernacles, we've lost equally impressive tabernacles. The Ephraim Tabernacle, Cedar City was razed decades ago. The Granite Stake Tabernacle is now the location of a bank. Lehi's building designed by Richard Kletting, the capital architect. Moroni was destroyed after it partly burned. The Tabernacle in Price was demolished. And the Ogden Tabernacle, we found the working drawings, the original linen drawings in the garbage can outside the office of the architect whose father had designed the building. How quickly we forget. Nebo was demolished. I had placed it on the National Register. The people couldn't be talked into saving it. There's a little bank there now. Pine Valley, now we go to meeting houses, ward meeting houses. Pine Valley, one of our purest 19th century buildings, has been preserved. Farmington Rock Church has been sensitively added to, 1860s building. And the 10th Ward in Salt Lake has been preserved, as has the 27th Ward near the avenues, in the avenues. The 2nd Ward, this is a in-construction picture. It has just been renovated. Forestdale has been saved. Levan, down near Nephi, has been kept. Beaver Dam, our firm was involved in adding to this building and restoring this little tiny building in a very tiny town in northern Utah. This is another one of our projects, building this new chapel in the middle with stone and Gothic windows from the building on the right and Greek Revival and stucco from the building on the left, so that rather than tear it down, you end up keeping the two original buildings on either side and a new one in the middle. And, of course, out of state, we still have such monumental edifices as the Wilshire Ward building. But, again, for all the ones we've saved, we have lost an incredible amount. Such important buildings as the Salt Lake 6th Ward, the 13th Ward. This was just torn down, the oldest remaining Gothic Mormon church in Utah, the 3rd Ward, built in the 1880s. There are now about six parking stalls there. The fourth ward was raised recently, and the doors are now in the church museum. Fairview, gone. 14th ward, unusual building, farmer's ward. The colossal and classical cledding Riverton ward is gone. All of these Salt Lake City churches, which perhaps none of us have ever seen or even have a concept that we ever did this kind of architecture, they're all gone. The 17th ward near where I used to live, still live, it has been demolished. And so forth. Even a little one-room church where there's not a big land boom, last I knew, has been taken down. Meeting houses throughout the state, Spanish Fork, Springville, substantial, well-built, usable buildings, the same kind of buildings that we're saving. The Park First Ward has been turned into a racket club. That is the site. Private, I think my time is going fast. I'm going to go speedily. Private and public groups have stepped in and helped the church in that they have saved a lot of Mormon-related buildings. The Forest Farm House, Pioneer Trail State Park, the Council Hall across from the Capitol, places like Pipe Springs have become parks. The Endowment House in Spring City, which I want to show you that the symbols have been put back that were taken off. Providence Ward and a lot of little tithing offices, Bishop's Storehouses. Some churches have been sold to other denominations and saved in that manner. And some of the houses have been saved, John W. Taylor's house, for example, by private parties. The 19th Ward is a community center and playhouse, but needs more work, and Michael's working on that. 18th Ward has been taken down and reconstructed across from the Capitol as sort of a reception chapel. 31st Ward has been kept because the church was willing to sell it and let other parties use it. But that strategy often backfires because sometimes they lose control of the future use of the building. One building down in Monroe was turned into a state liquor depot, and the chapel was lined with hubcaps for an auto body repair company. That did not sit well with the church or the people who had attended there. And so they have an attitude, let's tear buildings down before we sell the property. And that policy has resulted in a huge amount of demolition. Wasatch Steak Tabernacle has been saved, although alternately vacant and occupied and still kind of a question mark in the eyes of a lot of people. The Ephraim Co-op, probably our largest remaining cooperative building, has recently been restored, and in fact just opened, and the granary next to it has just been made into an art gallery in San Pete County. And I'm going to skip through. These are still question marks, buildings which are on the blocks and disposition unknown. Vernal Tabernacle, our most significant remaining unrestored tabernacle. This is a very poor photo, but it's a completely unaltered building from the turn of the century. And, of course, Academy Square, or BYU Lower Campus. This whole entire block of magnificent Victorian and early 20th century structures, their disposition is not guaranteed. These buildings may go down. Great efforts have been made by Gene England here and others to save these very important pieces of architecture. I think the church should not have sold them in the first place. Yale and Harvard and Cambridge, they would not sell off their old buildings. Those become the anchor buildings for campuses. Hotel Utah is in the process of being renovated, not as a hotel, but as a private office building, which I think is unfortunate since it's always been a symbol of post-polygamy, Mormon-Gentile accommodation. It's always been the meeting place and watering hole for the community, and now its doors are closed and people can't get in, and the interior is being altered, and I think it's an unfortunate development. These kinds of spaces will no longer be experienced by the general public. And finally, we have opportunities like Chesterfield, Idaho, where an entire Mormon community is still intact but not lived in. This could be a Western Nauvoo, Spring City, Grafton, or other examples. That's my last slide. Let me, I have a proposal, which I'm not going to have time to do, I think, because Michael is up. But let me just tell you what it is basically. without reading it specifically. I suggest that the church establish a department or a program specifically aimed at dealing with its historic properties, anything built before, say, 1940, and that this department have representatives on it from arts and sites, real estate, architecture department, finance department, history, any of the key players who have some interest in the outcome of church buildings. I think that this group should develop a criteria for significance based on National Register criteria for evaluating its church sites. Another criteria could be used to evaluate physical conditions of buildings. Now, we already have some of that in hand. They would need to be updated. But the purpose of this group would be to serve as a typical Landmarks Commission or Historic District Commission, in that they would be given the responsibility of evaluating and making recommendations on anything that happened to any of these buildings, additions, sales, gifts, demolitions, whatever. This group would be given the chance of doing feasibility studies, creating design guidelines for church buildings, encouraging incentives programs, and so forth. I've outlined kind of a specific program. I also think that affiliations with groups like Partners for Sacred Places and the National Trust for Historic Preservation would be very beneficial, both for those groups who have a lot to learn from the church and the church, which could learn a lot in return. I was going to end with a story about the Salt Lake Theater and all the factors that were in place when that was demolished, and how having such a policy or a department in place at the time would have perhaps altered the outcome. But I'd like to now give Mike a chance to respond. Thanks.
It is a true irony that somebody who is not from Utah, not of the prevailing faith, is asked to speak in response to what Alan said. Couple things that you all have to have a sense of suspension at the moment. If I get some of the things wrong, it's just I just haven't had a chance to really learn all the things that I need to in a year and a half of being in Utah. Prior to being in Utah and living in Alabama and living in the South, I know of people with white shirts, black pants, and bicycles, and that was the extent of my understanding of Mormonism, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. What I see is that there's a series of contradiction and ironies that are presented here. And the first is that are we dealing with the church as a monolith making actual decisions as the church, or is it individuals who make these decisions? Is it policy of the church, or is it policy of individuals? The church is young. And so with a church that is less than 200 years old, does it have an adequate sense of history? Given churches such as the Catholic Church, which has a longer sense of history, it has also, we could show slides of some of the great churches, Catholic churches that have been raised by the Catholic Church itself. So it's not necessarily in just the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints that has a history or lack of history of itself. The sense of persecution within the church's history has led the church to constantly build and leave, build and leave. So the idea that you would leave a hallmark building is not necessarily reprehensible, because you had to go somewhere else and you built new. And that policy sort of stays with you. The other thing, which is sort of the hallmark of the religion itself, at least as an outsider, is the sense of pragmatism. You have had to live with hostile surroundings, both of population bases and then coming here in the desert itself. The church's main concern, as all churches' concerns are, the religious leanings, the religious teachings of its flock, and to create adequate places for them to pray and to meet. And by the same token, there's a responsibility that the places that they offer the people to pray and to meet should have a heightened sense of religion. The contradictions that I see is that while there is great emphasis on the saving of souls, there is no emphasis on what those souls have done. We spend time trying to make sure that Aunt Thelma goes to heaven, but we don't care about Aunt Thelma's farmhouse, the three-dimensional representation on earth of what Aunt Thelma was about, of where we can see her and walk in her steps and go through the rites that she went through and have a greater understanding of her in the three-dimensional aspect. And the fact that the church has, through time, removed, through reasons that I don't know anything about, various aspects of iconography is another reason why buildings come down, because there's no physical reinforcement of an idea within the religion. It's all conceptual. And again, I may be not all the way clear on all this, but it seems to me, given the sense of having to have symbols that always represent things, three-dimensional objects that represent other concepts which have worked in other religions, you have a stronger hold on the buildings then, where in a religion that cuts it away from that and it becomes more conceptual in thought process. The church has, of course, through time, saved many places. In the 20s, in 1905, 1907, Joseph Smith's birthplace, the farm in the Grove, Brigham Young's birthplace was saved, though at Brigham Young's it's a marker. In the 20s, you have the Carthage Jail, Hill Cumorah, pronunciations please. Oakland, you had Kirkland. In Missouri, far west, Adam Udy. People in Alabama are that bright. You know, gotta let's get to the cut to the chase right here. We can do Cairo, Illinois perfectly, you know, and Louisville, with these other terms. Jackson, Liberty Jail, and Nauvoo. So it's not that the church is not without an historical sense. It's just that it's people-oriented and not necessarily building-oriented. And yet, the buildings were designed and built for and used by people. It's sort of an interesting understanding of how it works. The thing that I wonder about is that most of the things that were saved, most of the times in which it was pro-preservation in a sense, were by people who were either pioneers or were the direct descendants of the pioneers. And today's church is three generations, four generations removed. And so their concept of the new church and of trying to make the church modern is an entirely different sense of becoming in the beginnings and then recognizing the beginnings. It is interesting that we talk about pioneer days, and again, we always stress the people, and we talk about the great pride of which we have, of what we have done and built in the desert, and yet when we talk about what we built in the desert, we don't show the buildings. We show the people. Not to belabor a point, mind you. The things which I'm not sure about is that I think that what Alan would like to see happen is difficult. And the reason that it's difficult is that the problem is that the mindset of preservation is foreign, given the overriding objectives of the church, to fit into the general authority's understanding of how things need to be done. There's an educational process of trying to make people realize that the reinforcement of religion that people get from buildings is solid and true and good, and that we just can't deal about it by having slides and remembrances and talk about the people. I don't know enough about church doctrine to know if there's indeed chapter verses, we would say, that you could then use for your arguments to create a department within the church that would look at the buildings. But even if you created the department, the people who would be in that department still wouldn't have the correct educational background in which to view the buildings and its importance within the system in which they need to have proper response to the responsibility that they have. To ask a religion or any group of people to have a corporate historical responsibility is a very large undertaking. It takes a lot to try to charge a church with understanding a physical responsibility that you have to have towards buildings, in which those buildings, that money needs to be used for other items. I remember when I used to go to the Archbishop in Mobile about buildings that the Catholic Church owned, he would always remind me that, you know, Michael, the object of this church is to care for the people. And the buildings are temporary because when we all go to heaven where our souls will lay, that is the resting place that we care about. You know, and you're kind of hard to then say, well, gosh, Archbishop Liscombe, about the building that's falling down, I mean, people still live there right now, and what about their temporary souls and place to stay? Doesn't work real well. it's kind of hard to make that choice in the church. I think that it has to be done. I don't know of another religion, given even your age, that has such strong ties to a past and a strong ties to who you followed, and the idea that you still are struggling within the land not to have a sense of the three-dimensional object. I'm not quite sure when the break happened and how it happened, but it needs to come back so that you understand the people and what they have given you as your heritage. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. That was extremely informative, fascinating, heart-tugging, and I'm thrilled because we've got over 10 minutes for questions. I'm sure a lot of you will have things that you want to ask. So I'll have time for questions and just ask Michael and Alan if you would please repeat the question for the benefit of our tapes. And the tapes, by the way, will be on sale of this and of course, all the other sessions right out here afterwards. Thank you.
An important factor is that local people have a great deal to say about the disposition of a building that's still in use. For example, we've done a lot of restorations in northern Utah, and if the local people go on record as wanting to save a building, and the stake president supports that, the stake president has a lot of weight in the church office building. Actually, the process is not unified in that various buildings are under the domain of various departments. And so there are seminary buildings, church buildings, there are commercial buildings. There's no one person or one group that has the say for everything. And so what I'm proposing is that we make a list of everything, we decide how significant it is, that we put our greatest efforts in saving the most significant buildings, whether they're whatever kind of building they are, whether they're going to be continued to be used by the church or passed on to somebody else. Real estate has a say. The financial people have a lot to say about it. The arts and sites are consulted on buildings that are considered to be historic, but if they're not on some list, not yet discovered or whatever, really their advice doesn't come into play, and it's just advice. The architecture, the physical facilities people, make a lot of decisions, but they vary in their decisions. In northern Utah, we had a person who was very interested in saving buildings, and so we did. But in central Utah, southern Utah, and other places, there are individuals who care not at all for these buildings. I talked to the general authority who's over all of the buildings of the church, and he said to me that temples we build forever, and all the other buildings are expendable. And it's his view that renovation is more expensive than new construction. In our experience, having done over 100 buildings on the National Register in 15 years of all kinds, banks, schools, churches, houses, not a single building that was restored, even extensively restored, was more expensive than equivalent new construction. I think that is a good example. It's not a church building, so I didn't mention it, but it does give us samples, TV polls, newspaper polls, there were public referendums. I was involved in helping give grant money to that project win with the state, and I was surprised, frankly, that a majority of people voted to save and restore that building at a cost of $30 million instead of building a new building. They didn't want a new building. They knew that there isn't any such thing as equivalent new construction. There is no equivalent to that building. You could tear that building down, and you'd end up with something like the building down on 21st South, the county building. You know, the county chose not to participate. But I think that's an excellent example of really an incredible community support for saving a monumental building.
There's an irony in talking with one of the
presiding bishopric. We talked about the Uinta Tabernacle, and he brought up the problem that they're having in Brigham, the Brigham Tabernacle, and that is that it's oversubscribed. There are too many groups, too many people who want to use it. Prior to the restoration, it was an eyesore, nobody wanted it, and they thought it was expendable. They took on the sediment, they weighed it, they restored it, and now everybody wants to use it. And part of it is that most people don't understand structure. They think that visual decay is structural decay. And most of what you see in a restoration project is the gravity works on historic buildings like they do modern buildings. You know, if it wasn't structurally sound, it is pushed down by its own weight. But most of the problems are just visual and not structural. And so hopefully people can understand that and understand that once it becomes restored, it is a beauty. But most people don't have the training in their eyesight to be able to see beyond what they see right in front of them. They can't see it restored. They only see it as an ugly edifice. And it's a great example, because we try to use that to the church, saying, and here's a great example, and then, of course, the answer is, but that's an example. So I don't know.
That is a good one. I was one of the two project architects on that, and there are 40 uses a month in that building. Community use, I mean, everybody uses it. The building was restored for $742,000. A new sage cost $1.1 million. A sage is the small little meeting house with no windows and the chapel. Plastic oak, you know, etc. I mean, there's just no comparison. Yes? The question is there a policy regarding restoring iconography? I could give you the story about the Spring City Endowment House and how church leaders had the symbols removed on a building they didn't even own, and then a new owner came and put them back. I don't know that there is a policy, but the Star of David on the Assembly Hall windows and a gable, those were decorated with gold leafing with flower patterns to sort of obscure the Star of David. I think the guides still make comments about Ursa Major on the temple and the cosmological symbolism. I think there's not a lot of emphasis on that. Marty Bradley is going to give a paper later on steeples and the symbology of steeples. I think I would refer you to an article written by me in 1978, the rise and decline of early Mormon symbols, because I spend the whole paper identifying what all the symbols were, all-seeing eyes, clasped hands, and so forth, and then give pictures of them, explain the meanings of them, explain where I think those symbols were appropriated from, and what's happened to them. So rather than try to answer that, there's a 1978 issue of Sunstone. Yeah, I was on a committee to help save it, and there were several committees, really. And the fact is that the church is autonomous. The church can do what it wants to with its own property. If it's not getting money from the federal government, and if it's, it has to meet building codes and things, there is some push and pull. And there is a Landmarks Commission, and their role is to save buildings, but they only have a demolition ordinance that makes you wait for 5 months, so you can virtually destroy anything. You could pull a permit to demolish Salt Lake Temple and 5 months from now destroy it if you wanted to. There's nothing to stop them. If they want to change it into an office, I think it's odd that the Temple Square Inn, which was sort of a mediocre building, was at great cost renovated as a hotel, and then the hotel was made into an office building. I mean, it seems backwards to me. It's the grandest hotel in the entire Intermountain West. I have yet to see the interior. I'm going to suspend judgment until I do, but I'm opposed to the whole idea of taking it off the public blocks.
By the same token, the building is going to be physically, exteriorly saved, where the choice could have been to remove it entirely. So while it's not the use you may want, at least it can always be there. And that's a lot. It's something. I mean, you know, in their defense. I mean, I wasn't here during that problem. But it seems to me that one of the things they were looking at was removing the building entirely and placing a new building there.
Well, they had added on to it a decade before, right. and had spent something like $10 million on a fairly new addition. So they weren't going to demolish it. But there has been public outcry when the Desert Store went down. When the Social Hall went down, when the Salt Lake Theater went down, there's always been this huge social outcry. Sometimes it's listened to, sometimes the factor is overwhelming. Eagle Gate, they stopped the demolition for 3 months and allowed an engineering study to go on to consider whether they could save the building and take the tax credits. And after all the information was in, they decided to tear it down anyway. So the value of this proposal I have, which I didn't get to read, is that it would establish a policy that would be uniform and consistent, and therefore we as a public would know that once a decision had been made, it had gone through
a review that involved all the parties with an interest, including architects, preservationists, and so forth, and that they would all work together as a team to come up with the best solution, like any landmarks commission does, and that it takes the arbitrariness out of it. That's what's frustrating. You win some, you lose some. But the ones that won don't have any better reason for winning than the ones that lost. And so it would take kind of the guesswork out of it.
I just have one question. Stop everything.
Sorry, I didn't hear the question. Now, the Brigham City Tabernacle. Guess who's from Brigham City?
Boyd Packer.
And did he have anything to do with the building being saved? Of course. Who lives in Vernal? What general authority came from Vernal? You know, there's a town out there called Witso, and there's one called Talmadge, but they didn't live there. You know, it's the most important building in eastern Utah, but we don't have a champion for the building. So I think, yes, personalities do get involved. I know lots of stories of buildings being saved or air-conditioned or whatever because of some visit of some authority or somebody lived there or a friend of somebody. That's why I say we need to have a more uniform way of dealing with our resources and not allow this hit-and-miss kind of thing to keep going. Well, I think I'll just send a copy of the paper to somebody and see what happens. I don't have any inclination that they're looking for proposals from grassroots people on anything, really. But, there are ideas that eventually surface through, and it's not a whole lot different than what they've got now. The people would be the same. It's just the way these people operate. We already have the people in place, but we don't have the strategy in place.
Our time's up technically. Come on down and ask your questions. I know there's a lot more interest here. Thank you so much.